Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. The idea with this tagline, the cultures of consciousness, is that whatever happens inside our minds, inside our phenomenological experience of the world, is also shaped, programmed, constrained, and intensified by our cultural conditions, including our technologies, our language, our bodies, the way those bodies are organized in different societies, and that there's a delicate interplay, sometimes a very intense feedback loop between these two poles of our experience. And of course, in our technological world today, one of the greatest cultural mechanisms of consciousness, meaning something that shapes, tickles, triggers, subverts, undermines, satisfies, and confusingly frustrates consciousness is the internet. And it's hard to get our heads around the internet because the internet has got our heads within it. We're so absorbed now in these flows. They're so pervasive that it becomes extremely difficult to get a sense of what this thing is, if we can even think of it as a thing. And so I was very pleased when a new book came across my desk, SplinterNet, How Geopolitics and Commerce Are Fragmenting the World Wide Web, by Scott Malcolmson. Talk about Scott in a moment. But I really urge folks to read this book because it has a lot of very pleasing components to it. One is that it's delightfully short. Two, it's extremely clearly written, full of information, but in a very sort of lucid way. In the sense that you get a lot of context, a lot of historical facts, and a lot of detailed explanations of the various politics and machinations and institutional contexts that really form the sort of matrix out of which the internet evolves and that in many ways still influences it. I mean, in some sense, diving into history, one of the reasons to dive into history, and we do a lot of that in the show, and I do a lot of that in my work, is not just because history is an interesting story or history is the only story we have, but it's because there are effects, you can think of them as karmic if you want to, that linger on. And with the internet, we all sort of have this idea where people know, well, it was originally a creature of the military. Through ARPA, used to be called ARPANET, and that in some sense this kind of shapes the ethos or the possibilities of the space. And Scott really goes into much deeper detail about the military industrial context out of which the internet emerged, really going back to the 1920s and the very beginnings of the military industrial complex, as Eisenhower famously called it in the 1950s, and he takes this forward, giving us a really realistic, fairly non-judgmental approach, because if you get too judgmental about these things, then the book expands. And so what we have here is a very realistic, clear-eyed look at the actual players, including idealistic players, including the counterculture. And so his account of the way in which the counterculture influenced technology, which is something increasingly people recognize, we see the origins of Apple and Google and the sort of Bay Area matrix of progressive thinking and post-psychedelic culture. But he really goes into the real political effects of that idealism and how particularly the engineering subculture that was influenced by subcultural ideas really has had and to some extent still has a strong role to play as increasingly geopolitical forces fight over the internet, as the corporations and consumerist forces strive to turn it into a place to identify markets and in some ways isolate individuals as consumers. So again, with a, I think it only has less than 200 pages, it's really a one-stop shop for your big picture internet thinking. So Scott himself, when I saw this book, I was like, God, Scott Malcolmson. I used to know Scott Malcolmson, but I don't know if you, and then I looked at the back and it said he's a consultant on communications and political risk, foreign editor for the New York Times, served at the United Nations and the U.S. State Department. I was like, wow, this guy's kind of impressive. And I was like, no, I looked at the picture and I go, I know that guy. I used to work with him at the Village Voice. So back in the 90s, when I was a writer for the Village Voice, Scott was an editor at the literary magazine, the VLS, and we had a lot of fun editing and writing articles on UFOs and serious, important topics like that. So I was very pleased because I was already interested in the book when I realized it was the Scott Malcolmson I knew. So I was happy he joined us. So with no further ado, Scott, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Well, it's great to be back in conversation with you, Eric. I haven't looked at UFOs too much since then, but I've been following your work, and of course, Technosis is a timeless classic. So it's a real thrill to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of know to some extent that the answer to this question, but given the kind of work you've been doing lately. I'm curious why this book seemed important for you to do. A clear-eyed, realistic take on the geopolitics of the contemporary internet. In a way, it seems like the most obvious thing, that something that we should all have this in our minds. And yet there's something strangely elusive about these conflicts and these major players and the incredible power that has over us at this point, even though we all use this thing. So what did you see was needed here in terms of understanding the internet in a new way?
Well, I mean, it came. It's hard to know quite where to start that story, you know, because all stories just sort of go back farther and farther. I mean, in some ways, my initial great interest in the topic was as a journalist who was watching his industry collapse around him. Like several industries I've gotten into, like the international NGO industry, once I get into them, they seem to fall apart. That was certainly the case with journalism, and it was kind of vaguely blamed on the internet. And so I've been looking at the internet kind of from that perspective for a number of years, and working within the Times in particular, trying to figure out how the internet could be a great opportunity for journalism rather than the death knell of journalism. This particular project, I date to a meeting I was in England a few years ago. I was working as an editorial consultant with Eric Schmidt of Google and Jared Cohen, who's also at Google, but whom I initially knew when he was still at the State Department. And we were in England because we'd gone to interview Julian Assange at his country seat. He was under house arrest, as you know, I'm sure all your listeners know, for a number of years at the country home of a friend of his who is the founder of the Frontline Club. And so Eric and Jared and I went, and we had lunch and spent the afternoon, very long discussion with Julian about many different issues. The transcript of that, it was a confidential conversation, but since the transcript was eventually published in full on WikiLeaks, I don't feel like I need to keep the conversation secret any longer. When we were there, or rather afterwards, I was driving along with Eric. We were on the way to the airport, and the whole idea of anonymity on the web had been kind of weighing on me over the course of the afternoon. And, you know, just to state the obvious, the question of anonymity is a very, very important one for WikiLeaks' concept of what it's doing. It also, in thinking about it, I was thrown back to early bulletin board days, and when, you know, to participate in the internet was almost inherently to do something anonymous, and to be able to take on an identity, or often more than one identity, Our mutual friend Julian DeBell wrote a great book about that back in the 90s too. And it seemed to me, from trying to think about it from a commercial point of view, it seemed to me that if a consumer is three or four consumers rather than one consumer, that would in some sense only be a good thing. In other words, that impersonation, anonymous impersonation, real impersonation on the web could be a very commercially viable practice. But the Google's position and of course Eric's position that evening was that a single identity was really the way to go. And I'm sure your listeners remember a lot of the controversies about this a number of years ago with Facebook especially, but also with Google and other major Silicon Valley companies. That idea of exploring anonymity and how it did and didn't work in the context of online life was really the idea that propelled me into this book. That said, once I started the research, I really went in a very different direction, almost a traditional journalistic direction, which was to follow the money, the phrase made famous by Woodward and Bernstein and their source Deep Throat. I just started following who funded what in terms of the history of really of what led to the internet. And that then led me into a historical investigation of that question. What I found was that the military and intelligence roots, the military-industrial complex you talked about in your introduction, really dates to the First World War. And the use of chemical weapons, and particularly in the First World War, led the major powers to realize that the role of scientists in modern warfare was quite a bit greater than they had initially thought. And so the funding for what became a lot of the advances in computing and also in virtual reality in the interwar period, it really began in 1916. And as I sort of also got into the personalities of it, I found that people like Norbert Wiener and others who were much more familiar from the Second World War had kind of cut their teeth on these issues in the First World War, and in particular on the question of what's called fire control, which, to boil it down, is using math in order to more quickly respond to incoming fire or to hit a target.
Yeah, another way of thinking about
it. I can talk more about that if you like, but the fundamental idea of the virtual reality that is enabled by the number crunching of what eventually became called a computer is key to understanding both the history of computing, analog computing, and then digital computing right around the time of World War II, and then the internet itself, which, as I'm sure your listeners all know, was, particularly in terms of packet switching technology, but other technologies as well, really developed as a way to respond to possible intercontinental ballistic missiles or high-speed projectiles from long-distance planes. And in order to find them and basically respond more rapidly than you could respond if you were limited to the kind of math that humans would be able to do without the aid of a computer. And so that history sort of from 1916 to, let's say, the kind of mid-60s was something I felt it was very important to fill in. And I think, among other things, it establishes that both the virtual reality idea and the virtual war idea were kind of baked into the history of computing much longer ago than is normally understood or appreciated.
Well, let's stay with that for a little bit. I mean, again, I think probably most people here, you use the word virtual reality and think, what are you talking about? That's about goggles and a concocted reality, et cetera, et cetera. Talk about virtual reality and that important idea that part of what computers allow us to do is to very quickly and mathematically create possible scenarios and then be able to sort of winnow those down to the most efficient ones. In what sense can we say that the virtual reality was already an active idea in this growing military-industrial complex, at least in the 1930s?
Well, I mean, if I can be allowed to go slightly earlier than
sure.
that.
Sure, go ahead.
I think the 20s, best illustration of it really has to do with ship-to-ship warfare in World War I. And when you kind of cast your mind back to that period, planes were essentially irrelevant to warfare. The real way that a major nation could project its power overseas, or, over a long distance, was through having large ships with big guns on them. And the outcome of major naval battles was the sort of thing that would determine which great power won a conflict. What had happened with the improvement in accuracy and power of onboard guns was that ships would be at an ever greater length or distance from each other in a battle. And so there's one particular battle where I think the accuracy rate, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, but it was extremely low. I think it was under 1% in terms of shells successfully hitting their targets. And so this led the British and the Americans to look at how to improve the accuracy of fire so that they'd have a much better chance of hitting the opposing ship. So once you look at that, you have a fairly limited set of variables you have to deal with. There's the speed of your ship, the speed of the ship you want to hit, how much your ship is pitching, how much it's rolling, pitching being forward and backward and rolling being from side to side, the strength of your guns, the arc of their shell trajectories, the wind. There's a set of variables. It's not small. It's large enough that it's very hard to compute accurately. That really led to the question of how you take initially what were called firing tables and somehow mechanize that process so that you can get the information crunched quickly enough, and you can also change it in order to be able to increase the accuracy of fire. So what that amounts to is you're imagining a war. You're taking data variables. You don't even need to be on the ship necessarily. You're taking in the information, and you're trying to imagine forward in time based on the information that you have. That is virtual reality. That is what you're doing, and that's why fast forwarding a bit into the, I think it was around 1940 or so, maybe a bit earlier, that the machine, the analog machine that was able to make those calculations and improve the accuracy of fire was called a computer. And that was one of the very earliest uses for it. Prior to that, computers, at least in a military context, was really a term that was applied to the actual humans who did the mathematical calculations to input the variables into what were called the firing tables that I mentioned earlier. And even into World War II, the U.S. Army at its proving ground, which is a shooting ground, had well over 100 humans working there as computers. I mentioned Norbert Wiener, the father of cybernetics after World War II, very famous figure and a countercultural figure. His exposure to this was first in World War I, where he himself worked as a human computer. And you can take that, both the personalities and the concepts, really forward from imagining ship-to-ship warfare on into what we're more familiar with as virtual reality. Although I would say that even, Stuart Brand's famous article about SAIL and Xerox PARC and all that in the late 60s, I think, or maybe early 70s, was called Space War because it was about playing Space War and how all the geeks, around Stanford were playing this game, which had originated at MIT. You can take that Space War virtual reality metaphor using computers straight from 1916 and naval battles through to the early 70s and the beginning of the recognized countercultural period of the internet and of computer design.
Yeah, and one more thing about that plotting trajectory problem and Norbert Wiener, of course, is that once, if you have an anti-aircraft gun, for example, and you're trying to fire at a plane whose exact trajectory you can't quite know, one of the ways to make it more efficient is to take in the information based on the previous shot. Okay, you missed, you were short, you were too far ahead. You take that information into the computing in order to better compute the next shot. And that is the basic principle of feedback. And that it's that wartime model, even though Wiener's plots and plans were never actually manifested during the war itself, it was that war context that gave us this fundamental idea of feedback, of a machine that can learn from the environment. And that really just sets in motion the whole cybernetic revolution, which, you know, marks so much of our life. But talk a little bit more about Wiener, because he's such an interesting figure in the sense that he was on the one, you know, he's got one foot in this military industrial development, and yet on the other hand, he's a humanist, and he grows increasingly fearful and critical of the military establishment. So how did you kind of sort of react to him as a historical player in this plot?
Well, you know, he's an extremely sympathetic character in the I'm glad you mentioned the anti-aircraft stuff, because I mean, what he really did was he took the theories of statistical probability that had been developed in the 1930s, which were really revolutionary in terms of mathematics, and helped to apply those to the questions in the way that you're describing. I mean, he was a mathematician. He was also a very eccentric guy, like a lot, not to say all, of the pioneers of computing of his generation, as well as more famously of later generations. And, you know, he'd go on these crazy walks around Princeton that were called Wiener walks, because they were so sort of distinctively odd. He'd go swimming and smoke cigars while he swam, which I still struggle a bit to figure out how he managed to do that. And then after the war, of course, he became so concerned, as a lot of people, you know, famously Oppenheimer, but others who were involved in these technological efforts with the military during the war, they could see the immense destructive power of what they'd helped create and wanted to somehow, you know, dial it back or keep it from developing too far. You know, one of the people I talk about quite a bit is Vannevar Bush, who was a much more sort of conventional kind of character than Norbert Wiener. But he too, after the war, became, you know, he was against the hydrogen bomb. He wanted to have more arms limitations on nuclear weapons. It didn't really turn out that way, but he was, you know, he agitated for it, and Wiener just kind of basically abandoned the whole thing. I mean, he just didn't want to have anything to do with the military industrial complex that had been, you know, frankly, so crucial to American and Allied victory over Germany in particular, but also Japan during World War II. He really repudiated it and became a very articulate pacifist. The other thing which I find really interesting about Wiener is, simultaneously with becoming a pacifist, he also felt that and argued publicly that computers were going to be taking away jobs, or that machines were more generally were going to be taking away jobs, and that he felt that if the options were that would lead to a greater life of leisure for humans because machines could do work for them, or if that would really just imply that states and major corporations would have ever more power accruing to them, and that essentially the importance of an individual human would become smaller and smaller. He saw those as the two options. And he said very pessimistically, he said, you know, in the age of Bergen-Belsen, I'm afraid we're much more likely to take the latter option rather than the former.
Yeah, that's it's amazing when you go back and you realize how many of the dark shadows that we lumber under these days were already anticipated and indeed felt, particularly in the post-war period. I was just listening to an interview with Aldous Huxley from the late 50s. And, you know, it was just like a radio interview. It was just like a pop thing. And they were incredibly, not necessarily pessimistic, because they thought there was some hope, but the visions that they had were so strong. And it's kind of reminds us that in some sense we're still in a process that was in some ways kind of emerged from World War II. And another reason your book is really helpful is that in a very, sort of clear way, you show the linkages between, you know, institutions, boardrooms, individuals who move between the university sphere and the military sphere and the Washington, D.C. sphere, and really how a lot of people, both businessmen and technologists and, you know, military government folks, were kind of seeding the bed. We're kind of setting up the institutions and the concepts and the sort of interfaces that would allow the post-war to flourish with such alacrity in America. And you particularly do that as a way of answering this question that a good chunk of your book is devoted to, which is, why California? Why did the internet and so many technology industries emerge in California, particularly in the post-war period? So, and you, I gotta say, there's, you know, I wanna have you riff on this, but there's one of my favorite lines in your book, and it also captures what's nice about your writing, where in a very crystalline fashion, you get a lot of the psychology that's going on here. That's the thing. This isn't like a dry sort of book about just, you know, this guy was doing this, blah blah blah. You really get into the sort of feeling and of these characters. But you say something about California and how it sort of what was driving the sort of psychology of the place as it stepped into this technological future, where you describe the combination of envy, ahistoricity, resentment, self-confidence, and creative energy vis-a-vis the East Coast establishment. And I read that, I was like, man, this guy understands California all too well. But talk a little bit about what was happening in California and what it was institutionally in terms of major figures. What really created it as this technology, you know, megalopolis that we know today?
Thank you. I should probably just let your audience know that I am a native Californian. I was born in Pomona. I actually grew up, I would have been born in Claremont, but it wasn't big enough to have its own hospital back then. And we moved to Oakland in 1968, and that's where I grew up. And then I went to Berkeley. So I was able to see much of the 60s and 70s, admittedly as a very young man, unfold in the Bay Area. So I mean, I love California, and it's, if I critique California, it's definitely a friendly, very very friendly critique.
Absolutely.
I think the best place to start with that really is with two figures in World War II. One of whom is Frederick Terman, and let me talk about Fred Terman for a minute first before I get on to General Doriot. Terman's father was a professor at Stanford, if I remember correctly, of psychology. I'm not quite sure about that. And Terman, so he grew up in Palo Alto, which had done a lot of work on radio. There was a fair amount of innovative technological work going on in the Bay Area, even actually before 1900. But and so he came up as an engineer. He came out to I believe it was either MIT or Harvard to work on a project run by Vannevar Bush. And it had to do with over the horizon radar, which is again another form of virtual reality. It's a question of how a machine can take in information about some place it can't see and create a reliable version of it. That was his project during the war, very secret work during the war. He returned to Stanford and to the engineering faculty and became over the years an immense figure at Stanford. He was the one who really pioneered the Stanford Industrial Park. He was the one who really pioneered the connections between post-war between government and the university in terms of weapons development and other forms of projects for both the intelligence services and for the military in the I guess stricter or more traditional sense. So what grew up at Stanford under Terman's leadership and sort of, you know, influenced by his experience and his contacts back east, that's one very, very important trajectory for how the industry came to grow up in the Bay Area. The second part that I talk about in my book has to do with a fellow named Georges Doriot, who was actually French but came to the United States between the wars, and was a, you know, kind of a center right figure. Basically, he settled in at Harvard as well, at the business school, celebrated figure, and he was recruited into government in World War II, essentially to supervise the development of new products within new technology within the military. He succeeded at that. He left the war as he ended the war as a lieutenant general. He was very decorated and very, very well thought of. He had been involved with venture capital prior to entering the Army and entering Army service. And when he left Army service, he again went into venture capital and founded what really is the first non-family money-based venture capital firm. What he learned in the military was that if you had a lot of money, you could throw a lot of money at a variety of projects, and it didn't really matter if a lot of them failed because a couple of them would succeed. That model, of course, is kind of fundamental to how venture capital works. In the case of military equipment, the success wasn't measured in dollars; it was measured in lives saved or in the eventual victory. But the idea was fundamentally the same. Doriot's firm was the one that gave the money to DEC, Digital Equipment Corporation, which then became a huge early success of the computer industry. Doriot's ideas came out to Stanford mainly through various figures who started the first major VC firms. Like there was a firm Davis and Rock, which was founded in 1961. Tommy Davis had been in the OSS, which is precursor to the CIA, in Burma, and then came out to California and had a great success with the Davis and Rock firm. Another one of the big early firms was led by General Anderson and General Draper, and so on. I go into more detail in this in the book, but Draper, Gaither, and Anderson was another key firm in those days. Two generals plus Rowan Gaither, who was the main figure in starting the RAND Corporation, and one of the main sort of analysts behind the idea of a missile gap.
Let me stop you there.
Eisenhower administration. So anyway, I don't mean to go on about it.
But I just want to ask you one question, just to clarify. Yeah. It's like, in addition to the fact that there's a lot of military people who are playing significant roles, either in funding or in technology development itself in the post-war period, it's also the case that, if I understand you, especially in terms of the money, which is such an important part of this whole technology sphere, is that in a way, people realize from World War II that if the government is spending tons of money, they're going to make a lot of breakthroughs with the kind of technologists and scientists that you have in the United States. And so it's like, well, now the war is over. We don't have that enormous spigot anymore. How can we recreate those conditions in a peacetime format? How do we make that kind of sort of financial flow possible in order to continue to succeed with innovation? I mean, in a sense, World War II was an experience on America's side of innovation and its relationship between money and these kinds of institutional actors that operate between military and government and the university.
No, that's it. Yeah, that's exactly right. The amount of money that the United States was able to spend or that the Pentagon was willing to spend in the few years of World War II really, you know, taught a number of lessons. One of those lessons was that you could have immense innovation if you were willing to throw a lot of money at a bunch of projects, and a few of them would come through. And that was very much the experience of the war. And then, having learned those lessons, that was the model that a number of investors brought out to California, whether they were originally Californian or not, but they happened to be in California, and they brought those ideas out there. I mean, Dorio had been working on the same ideas prior to World War II, but it was only the experience of the war and the success, so to speak, of the war that really made the model really viable and sort of, you know, now it seems obvious, but it was really, really not obvious at the time.
So then you have all this development in California, particularly Northern California, but also in the, you know, Southern with the aerospace, et cetera, and RAND and all that. And this also happens to be for reasons that are both different and not so different. The place where the counterculture really blooms with its most and greatest intensity. One of the positive features of your book is you tell a very level-headed, sympathetic, loving, but also critical story about the influence of the counterculture on the computer industry. Now, that's something that's increasingly mainstream, but it's usually treated in a fairly superficial way. It's like, oh, well, you know, Steve Jobs did acid and went to India, and then, you know, he blah, 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 blah. But there are, of course, much more fundamental and important ways that the idealism of the counterculture, including its weird mixture of sort of progressive internationalism and libertarian, you know, self-creation, which in some ways is a fundamental antagonism that the counterculture can never really work out. And that kind of infused the culture of engineering and the culture of folks who were reimagining the internet and who would increasingly come to play an important role in guiding its future as it became useful beyond this sort of military industrial complex that you have set that, you know, that had been developed over the previous decades. So could you sort of talk a little bit about what the most sort of important in a political sense, what are the most important outcomes of the countercultural ethos were in terms of guiding the development of the internet in the 70s and 80s and on, as it became increasingly clear that this is a great tool to do a lot of stuff, and that this countercultural legacy really had a and continues to have an important role to play in that increasingly global conversation.
Well, it's, as you know, a pretty complicated story. I mean, I would focus on a couple of particular elements in it that get at the tension that you were just describing. On the one hand, you look at the internet and it's in the strict sense in the late 1960s or through the 1960s. The military question was to be able to communicate and to be able to, you know, build enough redundancy into a system that it could withstand attack. There was a lot else going on in the development of the internet, but that was kind of the sort of fundamental threat. So that you could envision as an idea of community. It was an idea of community. It was an idea of survivable community. And for people maybe sort of my age and a bit older, who sort of had to dive under our desks every couple of weeks to practice for raids and the like as children, you know, the idea of a survivable community is an extremely powerful one, emotionally powerful, and seems very important under what we perceive to be the threat of possible nuclear annihilation. So you have that sort of thread of development of what would come to be machines talking to machines, but was ultimately people being able to talk to continue talking to other people, not to, you know, be overly dramatic about it. One of the things that really interested me in looking at the kind of the engineering counterculture that developed in Berkeley and that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and others were part of, in the sort of home brewing aspect of it, homebrew computer club and so on. Their real interest was not in community. Their real interest was in individuals being able to do like crazy stuff with machines. And I find it interesting the way that in the 60s and 70s, these are really two sort of, you know, basically kind of different impulses. One to sort of empower or even super empower the individual, and the other to create a network. And when those two really come together, it took them a very long time to come together. I mean, the military continued to develop the internet, you know, more or less in pristine isolation, and then got a little tired of it, to make a long story short, and it was given over to the National Science Foundation, which created NSFNet. The internet was then developed really by scientific researchers in the Bay Area, but also in many other places. And of course, famously, eventually, Tim Berners-Lee in Switzerland and Robert Caillaux, his collaborator in France. But that was really a scientific community. People, scientists wanting to be able to communicate with each other. That was how email got developed and so on. And the personal computer revolution really was on a separate and, you might say, fundamentally much more libertarian line of development than the internet was. And these two really only powerfully came together in the late 80s, which, you know, and the early 90s, which was when you and I were part of the counterculture in Greenwich Village. But what interested me as a sort of analyst or researcher was how separate those two were. And there were people, for example, at SAIL, the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, who wanted to really develop the internet aspect of it. And they were kind of spurned by the homebrew type people who really wanted to be really powerful individuals. So that tension was there within the engineering community really from the beginning. I mean, from the point when you could speak reasonably, beginning around 1960, of a global engineering culture that was working on these problems together.
So listen, Scott, we could keep going into the 80s and 90s, but
let's bring it forward.
15 minutes left here. I always do this. I'm a history buff, so I just love this stuff, but. I want to turn to today, you know, and I want to talk about, you know, one way into it is just to say, as corporations and states have increasingly taken over the kind of the guts of the internet, if you will, what's sort of the legacy of this countercultural impulse? If we recognize it as a kind of, even as a kind of contradiction, but it's still a very idealistic one between the possibilities of community and learning and internationalism and connection, and the possibilities of a certain kind of freedom in self-determination and self and individual growth. If we kind of identify those as part of this engineering idealism that has had, still has a lot to a big role to play in the development of the internet and computing, increasingly interlinked personal computers. How is that playing out now when the world is at such a conflict heavy, heavy duty, storm clouds rising state?
I guess the thing I'd focus on first is basically a business model question. The technology of something like Google or just any search engine technology, really, certainly the technology of a social network, it's not a contradiction exactly, but the relationship between the individual and the collective is a somewhat fraught one. Obviously, these companies make money on individuals rather than groups, just to, you know, to make a slightly bald statement. They collect information on individuals, which enables them to either themselves or to enable other companies to sell things to individuals. And the more you know about an individual, so the theory goes, the more likely you are to be able to sell to them. So that has to do with individual information. The attractiveness in many ways to an individual, however, for participating in that process is not to get ads more targeted at them or to give away more and more of their personal information. Rather, it's to enter into a world where they might establish some kind of collective tie, or where they might enter into some kind of community. You know, there are lonely surfers and there are lurkers and that kind of thing, but to use a now outdated term. But fundamentally, you enter into that world because it's a bigger world than the one that you would otherwise have. And so there's a kind of a tension there. As these companies grew and as they got more and more information, governments increased their interest in what they were doing, because the more information that governments have, the more they're able to pursue their own security agendas, whether it's espionage or law enforcement or any number of other things, or gaining office or wielding influence and so on. And so, I don't think any of those companies in 2002, 2003, I guess Google actually started in 98, but, you know, as it got in the course of the 2000s, I don't think they dreamt, I hope they didn't dream of ever greater surveillance, but what they did do was create a system of information that is like catnip to a government. And I say this sympathetically, having served in government, but for a government to be able to get that kind of information, it's really almost irresistible. And so obviously now we have this tension between Silicon Valley and Washington, you know, the way it gets expressed mainly in the United States, but it's really a global thing, where you have companies that want to grow and therefore their model takes them to more and more information about people. But you have them in tension with governments who want to use that information. And there's no obvious way out of this problem. I mean, in some ways it drives me back to what motivated me in the first place, though I hadn't until now thought of it that way, which was, you know, is there a way to create anonymity that's nonetheless, maybe there is, I don't know, but the way that corporations work now is that it's not, that you need to have an individual, that there needs to be a credit card number associated with that individual in order for them to really be valuable to the system. So, you know, governments are more and more trying to take that information and control it, which means creating what China's president Xi Jinping has repeatedly described as internet sovereignty, which basically means controlling the information about your own citizens. And that is a very, very strong trend. My disappointment in some ways in the United States has been that over the last couple of years, really since the Snowden revelations, I suppose, the security agenda has taken over and shaped the overall government approach to internet issues. And with respect to the internet, as I would argue with respect to pretty much anything a government does, if you let the security interests overwhelm other interests, it's very hard to claw that back. So I think that's kind of the position that we're in now. As far as the engineering counterculture goes, I actually think that they have an enormous role to play. It's complicated because it's a completely, utterly unelected, in many ways unknown counterculture. It's way out of the public eye. And most people that I know in that counterculture want to continue to be way out of the public eye. The governance structure of the internet was built up chiefly by that counterculture. And, of course, the late John Postel being the most famous figure in that, and I talk about him in my book along with other people from that period, particularly in the 80s and 90s. That counterculture continues to exist. It has an inherent interest in an open internet, and it's doing its best within these very obscure negotiations between states and other bodies to figure out how the internet is going to be controlled, what the role of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which is the main administrative body for the internet, how sort of power will be divvied up, what the different roles will be for ICANN and for the other major players like the regional internet service provider regulators. this is all extremely obscure stuff. Very few people pay attention to it, but it is in its own way a kind of countercultural counterweight to the obvious alternative, which would be that states will carve up the internet in the way that they carve up most other things. I wish I could say that there's a country now that sort of sees all this and is playing a wise and benevolent role in shaping it for the better, but I don't really see that, and certainly particularly China and Russia, not to pick on them, but the current governments in both those countries are really trying to figure out how to get as much state control as possible of the internet, and the global sort of engineering counterculture that, you know, produced things like open source and is very deeply involved in ICANN and the other governance bodies, is sort of in its quiet way trying not to give away the store to states. And I think we should all hope that they succeed.
Yes, very much. And there's another point you made that I never thought about in terms of, again, kind of the psychology of these players, is that states are in a complicated situation because they increasingly depend on these tools and technologies that come from corporations that have their own agenda. So there's a weird tension between, you know, the State Department and Google or Apple or whoever's hosting their information, who's ever building the servers that carry their data and that organize things. So how is that working out in terms of one of the things you mentioned, that's one of the things that's happening now or has been happening recently, is that states are increasingly building sort of alternative internets that are under their control, are much safer, are much more secure than the public internet, and that this isn't necessarily a bad thing in the big picture. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a real question whether it's a bad thing or not. I mean, on one hand, to oversimplify, the idea of sort of multiple internets, each kind of going its own way and finding new creative ways to interact and so on, is a very attractive one. On the other hand, if the state's motivation is fundamentally not about openness, but about the control of information and the control of its citizens, then, basically 10 non-innovative and clamped down internets versus, you know, one slightly better internet seems to me like a fairly easy choice. I mean, I would like to think that multiple internets would be awesome, but if you look at the motivations of states, it's pretty hard to see how that would. I just think it's highly unlikely. And I'm glad you pointed out those tensions there. I'd add one or two points to that, because I did spend a lot of time with, you know, very high level people in the military intelligence and diplomatic worlds in Washington and elsewhere as I was researching my book. And the fear that their missions would be made very difficult by private companies having an effect, not a monopoly, but a immense control over innovation in technology, militarily relevant technology, that fear runs really deep. And if it runs really deep within the American military and intelligence establishment, you can imagine it probably runs even deeper within the other military and intelligence establishments around the world. That's sort of point number one. And then a related point is just the question of personnel. It's very hard for government to compete in attracting the best engineers, the best minds in technological development. And that is an immense concern in Washington. That's why Ashton Carter has been into Silicon Valley so many times in his term. But again, it's from a California point of view, it's interesting. You know, there are good reasons not to want to work for the Pentagon. I mean, I say this as I'm as patriotic as the next person, but you know, there are very good and deep reasons within the Bay Area culture, certainly, to feel like innovation should not ultimately be at the service of the state. And I hope that the Valley and other innovative centers around the country are able to sort of keep that ethos alive. And I think they will, but it's something you'd have to kind of remind yourself of every day.
Yeah, we just got 2 minutes left here, but I do want to throw in one thing is that we didn't talk about is just how the hacker and the hacker ethos has sort of changed and become much more embroiled in issues of surveillance, zero-day exploits, the sort of espionage, and the way in which they function, trading secrets with different kinds of governments. So we're not just talking about America; we're talking about all sorts of governments, all using these kinds of tools. And there's sort of a new kind of weird geopolitical hacker, trader, black hat wearing character that's emerged over the last couple of decades. This will be the last comment, but where do you see that happening? I mean, the hacker once was a kind of libertarian prankster or someone who was always devoted to liberating things or exploring, even if, and sometimes a kind of juvenile way. And now they're major players in these global espionage tensions. What's up with that? How did that happen?
I think I have 45 seconds, don't I?
Yes, you do. But I had to get the hackers in there.
Right. I'm not.
It's time for a hacker haiku.
In the book, I don't know if I can do it justice in the next few seconds. I mean, I just happened to notice today an article about a DARPA program that went out for bids, which is essentially the Pentagon feels that it should be able to crunch the numbers to establish the identities of hackers through methods, through all the things you could imagine. And so they're starting a program to identify them and create a database of them and so on, which kind of takes us full circle in a way. I don't know. I mean, I want to end on a hopeful note, so I'll end on this one. In the world that we're in, where governments are asserting their control over the information space and trying to control their citizens as much as they can, the information about them, the information they consume, I think that there is that creates an immense need and I hope an opportunity for the hacker culture to turn its energies to finding ways to subvert that. You know, I mean, it's not enough to just sort of point to VPNs or, you know, Telegram or one thing or another. I mean, this is long-term work to make sure that the citizens of states, particularly authoritarian states, don't become isolated, even though their governments might be able technologically to do that. That seems to me a worthwhile cause for a new generation of hackers.
And a wonderful note to end on. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. Great to talk to you again.
Malcolm's book is Split Net.